All right, so those who might be joining us new tonight, who are coming new to this Seattle Insight, we do this Monday night is kind of a, I don't know, kind of an intermediate class series that we try to keep my talk from flowing away. We often take subjects which are a little bit deeper into the practice. But of course, you're welcome to come. So we don't spend a lot of time with the introductory technique. That's more on an intro class. And this year, Tweri, the other guiding teacher, myself, wanted to take these 10 ox herding pictures. We were taking them from the Zen tradition and using it as a way to explore our own practice. So it's a visual graphic way of exploring how our spiritual practice, different stages we can go through. So it's presented as a linear process, but of course it's can be very much circular, that we might find ourselves jumping back and forth in different pictures. And each picture, each image has a way of teaching us. I'll describe what this month's image is. And that's of, it's just simply of a person sitting quietly in a hut, in a very simple thatched hut. There's a sense of peace, a sense of ease with that. And that's picture number, was it seven, six, seven? Okay, so the previous six pictures, if you those of us who walked along this path with us, know it's there's much more action going on, much more struggle at different times, the release of that struggle. And it's all focused around this ox. Okay, so the ox really represents different things. It can represent our true nature, what we truly are after we release our ego, when we understand the nature of all things. It can also represent our practice itself. It can represent the sense of really of our effort, of our the techniques that we use. And so we use different ways of exploring that in this series. So let me read the picture's verse. So astride the ox, I reach home. I am serene. The ox too can rest. The dawn has come. In blissful repose within my thatched dwelling, I have abandoned the whip and ropes. All right, so again, there's been this huge movement of trying to find the ox, trying to search for it, seeing glimpses of it, trying to catch the ox, trying to tame it. Finally, it's tamed. We can actually ride it home. And what we're riding at home is really to our true nature. Now, this particular image is really in contrast to all the other ones, at least so far. And it represents a falling away, a sense of releasing, releasing our effort, releasing our kind of our egoic striving, our egoic wanting something outside of ourselves. It represents letting go of kind of the form that we took in our practice. Last week, we talked about the metaphor the Buddha used of a raft, used to take us across this river of suffering, of confusion, to this other shore. Okay, once you get to the other shore, we don't have to carry that raft around. And so it's a point to just to reflect upon in our own practice that whatever technique we might use as meditators, at some point, if that technique is really effective, there's a letting go of that technique. There's a way we transcend the technique. Keeping the technique clutched to us, keep holding to it, there's a point where you have to release that. And we'll touch upon that tonight also. The ox can also represent, in some ways, the goal of our practice, our initial goal. And this ox is something that's mysterious. It's calling to us. We're looking for it, finding it. And that's our understanding of what spiritual practice is about. And this is the funny thing about practice is that at some point, what we think we were looking for isn't really what is there. It's something very different that starts to show itself. And this is such a powerful image of this ox that we've been just obsessed with, really, is suddenly gone. It's forgotten. The ox is forgotten. But the self remains. And so when that goal falls away, and that goal is really was embedded in our normal strategies or normal egoic way of approaching life, it works for a lot of our things we do in our life. We learn how to navigate, how to do our jobs, how to navigate relationships, how to build things and take apart things. It's all very helpful, but it has a certain limitation in terms of the spiritual path, and that's where we run up into. So this letting go represents not only our idea of what we thought we were trying to do, but also the logic, the rules that apply to it. All this is starting to fall away. And it's not because something is wrong with our practice. It's actually because the practice has worked in a very profound way. It's worked so deeply that we can release as long as we recognize that. So tonight, I'd like to explore this in a couple ways, three different ways. The first is what's absent in this stage or in this image. What has fallen away? The second thing I want to explore is how can we kind of encourage that to arise? How can we create the conditions, or when does it arise? Just, you know, is it out of the blue? Is it causing conditions? And finally, once that arises in us in our practice, how do we shift our practice to better align with that state? All right. So what is absent in this stage? What has fallen away? That's interesting to reflect on. Is this a state? Is it a state of mind or state of meditation that's just suddenly arisen through maybe working on concentration or just sincere practice? Or is it also, could also be an insight, a seeing life, things in a very different way, seeing how what we took to be solid as not being so solid. They can actually be both aspects. Sometimes those get blurred together. It's something that's really induced by our particular technique versus seeing clearly. And particularly in this tradition, we use techniques and practice to help create the conditions to see more and more clearly. And we can see this in small ways. You know, from day one, when we first start to learn to practice, how we can see how little control we have over our thinking mind, how the mind just keeps going wherever it wants to. And we think, well, we have a lot of control over it, but until we try to say, I'm just going to focus on my breath for 30 minutes and nothing else. You know, we were often shocked by how unsuccessful we are. And that's that first picture of that, starting to look for that ox. Now, what's absent in this stage? I want to just explore that because it helps us create these kind of guideposts for our practice. We can start to recognize when those arise. I think all of these that we're going to talk about, and also just from this time forward in this series, they can operate in a spectrum, right? Can it be a very profound kind of world-changing view experience, or it can be just very subtle. We don't even notice that we've shifted that way. I think that whole spectrum, it can be helpful for our practice to start to sense how those happen in small ways and little ways, not to overlook those. They also help us become a place we can practice. You know, how do I practice to release some of these things, to encourage those things to fall away? And these are not a complete list. This is just from my own experience that I thought I would share for this aspect of this one section of the talk. What's released? The first is the release of time. The release of time. Now, often we are very time focused. Even if we are kind of abstract in our kind of natural state, there's still a sense of the future, what's coming forward, what's happened in the past. There's a sense of how can I get this moment to hurry up and be done with if it's unpleasant? How can I have this moment hang on longer if it's pleasant? You're usually focused on that. That sense of how much longer, how much more this has to go on. And perhaps you've noticed this in your own meditation practice. How many of you have been like, I can't wait till that bell rings? Yeah, leaning into the moment, wanting the bell to ring so I can alleviate maybe that achy leg or not have to try to be focused or repressing. I can finally let my mind relax and be distracted. Or perhaps sometimes in the middle of the meditation, it just has that timeless and you want to hang on to that. You don't want that moment to end. The bell rings and you won't wish to continue. Now, when we're in this stage or this picture, there's a sense of time falling away. It's not so much that it's more like just there's a sense of immediacy is probably a better way to say it. We're so much in the middle of the moment, middle of what's here, and there's no movement into the past or future. We're just simply resting right here in this present moment. There's a sense of ease, a sense of a repose. There's nothing that needs to happen, nothing that needs to change. So how to work with that sense of time? I was walking my dog this morning and feeling a little rushed to get on with my day. And of course, his agenda is much more timeless. You know, he wants to sniff this brush and then the next bush 3 yards later. And, you know, it just kind of this, he's just delighting in all the, one friend talked about it as the pee mail, you know, all the other dogs marking the territory. And here I am trying to impose my own time driven. Remember with my daughter when she was young, she, you know, trying to get her to preschool or kindergarten or something. And she's just relaxed going about her morning experience. And we're like, okay, we got to leave 5 minutes ago to get there on time. And you can feel if you've been in those situations, how it's oppressive that you're pushing something that's naturally unstructured by time into something that's time constrained. And of course, as parents or as anyone in this role, we struggle with it, right? I think that's one of the cultural things that's, I don't know if it's unique, but there's a few cultures which are very time-driven. You know, some of the East Western European cultures, some of the Asian cultures, it's like time is very important, showing up on time, being respectful. While other cultures, like my wife worked in Brazil for an NGO, a meeting was supposed to start, scheduled to start at 1 o'clock, and people start showing up at 2:30, and there's just a much more relaxed relationship to time. So that's part of our kind of cultural forcing into time. So start to play with that whenever you can. You say, oh, what if I can just, does it really matter if I run late? Does it really matter if things don't happen on time? Sometimes they do, but sometimes you can relax that tendency. Important thing is to notice your constriction around time, how tight we get around it. Another aspect that shows up is when we want the moment to hurry up. We want to get through this moment. It's boring. It's not. It's unpleasant. It's irritating. Practice relaxing into it like it's never going to change. How would I relate to it if that sound's going to always be there, if this situation's always going to be there? How would I change my relationship to it? And then also noticing how time falls away on its own accord when we're really touched by something. Like if you've ever been with someone who's on their deathbed, there's a sense of timelessness. You're just meeting them, just how they are. Or someone who's just been born, there's a sense of stillness. It's like time just falls away. Sometimes nature can elicit that, seeing a beautiful sunrise, sunset. You just fall into that place of stillness. These are all important guideposts and clues, because sometimes we think we have to go through all these steps in order to get to this stage. But really, it's available right here and right now. Just a simple shift of our perception and shift of our relationship to the moment. So the release of time. Another big element in this stage that falls away is a sense of doing, a sense that something needs to be changed, that there's something that needs to be modified or tweaked or improved upon. We've noticed this under a microscope with our meditation practice, that we're sitting and we're trying to like, okay, I've got to focus a little bit more on my in-breath or a little bit more on my out-breath, or I have to release that hindrance. I have to find a way to navigate that. And of course, that shows up in big ways in our life, how we try to control how things show up. how things unfold. So not to say we don't make plans, we don't try to orchestrate things better for ourselves and others, for the world. But going down to this very moment, there's a sense of perfection in the moment that arises. There's a sense that absolutely nothing needs to be done. The times that I've felt this, it's by contrast, you notice how often there's always that little bit of pressure that I have to do something a little different with this moment. And when that impulse has fallen away, that there truly is just this resting in the moment, there's nothing that needs to be done. That this very moment has a perfection. It's a striking contrast. So it's a sense of contentment, a sense of equanimity, that nothing needs to be changed. And so doing, of course, we can use that very broadly in terms of judgment, comparison, fixing, problem solving, even labeling, even writing down, even improving, all those aspects, when we fall into the stage, fall away. There's just this complete rest in the moment. Complete rest in this moment. So how do we cultivate that? How do we practice with that? This is actually really built into the meditation techniques. Now we ask, especially with the insight practice, just simply to observe something like the breath, to listen to a sound, to feel a sensation, and don't add anything to it. Not try to change it, not try to prolong it or shorten it, but just have it, live it, have its own lifespan, its own experience, its own arising. It's really a gift to allow something to do that. So often as human beings, we're always trying to change things, try to eradicate what we don't like and prolong what we do. So we learn to do that very simply with the breath. So the breath is just simply breathing itself. It's arising and passing away. So we practice that. We learn to change that to different objects of meditation, like sound, like sensation. But it's meant to be a training for how we actually show up in the world. The next time you're with somebody, I mean, not far out in the future, but the very next time, see if you can be with them in a moment without any agenda, without any expectations. Just say, well, you know, how are you? What is here? Sometimes I ask, like a checkout clerk, how are you? And I try to come from this place. And it's often they can sense that you actually are curious, you're actually present instead of going through the motions. And they often share, maybe they're struggling with something very personal. It's that gift of simply being present without that agenda. So taking this, the way we practice it with the breath, in much more subtle, deeper ways, even to that sense of you who's watching, you who's witnessing, that's a subtle form of doing. I'm kind of re-engaging the sense of me as the meditator, me as the watcher. That's starting to really thin, to use Rodney's phrase, starting to really become smaller and smaller in this picture. This picture still has the self there, right? Next picture, the self goes away. We'll explore that next month. And another aspect, the third aspect on this section here, what falls away, is around thought. Thinking and thought. So we can think of thought as kind of momentary arising, and thinking is like the engagement, the process of adding more and more thoughts. So in these moments, these states arise, and this picture arises, there's a lot of natural quiet. There's a lot of space between thoughts. It's like the thoughts just don't keep ongoing generating themselves. Now, many people start meditation, and I teach a lot of intro classes, and often people say, I came to meditate to quiet my mind, to stop my mind from thinking, right? So, and many people get discouraged when they realize how hard that is to do. Because the trick is that when we have this idea, I want to quiet my mind, that's actually a thought in itself. So trying to use thought to quiet thought, or analogy I like to use, if I had a hammer and I made a hole in the wall, and I was trying to stop the hole from getting bigger by using the hammer, I wouldn't be very successful just making the hammer bigger, the hole bigger and bigger, because the hammer only knows how to pound, to make dents. So learning to quiet the mind is really, you can see it reflected in these ox herding pictures. Maybe that, let's say that is our goal. We just realize that there's so much suffering by how much my mind's thinking, how obsessive it is, how much anxiety, how much worry, how much comparison, how much judgment. Stop me when I get to yours. You know, we just, this is part of the human nature. You know, we're always thinking, always planning, always worrying, fantasizing. Different shapes we take on that process based on our history, our conditioning. But pretty much all of us, we think a lot. We're almost addicted to the thought process. So looking at the ox herding pictures is the teaching around that. That first inclination that, oh, something about my thinking mind is the problem. It's like first searching for the ox, but there's some way to release this thinking mind. We think the solution is to catch that darn ox and train it and make it mine, right? So we go about that process. We start to train, learn how to meditate, learn how to count our breaths or note our breaths. We know how to start to release our thinking mind. This goes through all the different stages of searching for the ox, catching the ox, trying to tame the ox. And there's often a point when we really become in opposition to our thinking. We have thought arises and we judge that. That's something I try to get early on and instill in people, is that not to judge your thinking mind, not to judge it. And just actually appreciate how strongly it thinks, how good of a job it's done for you. By doing that, you're no longer in opposition to it. It allows the thoughts to start to quiet. And that's how we see in these pictures evolve, that there's a gradual, from that struggle to the ox, to this training of the ox, and eventually this unity, the little figure in the ox, that sense of connection, right? Riding the ox home. And then we're in the place where meditation, when thoughts arise, we are able to see them. We know that they're thinking. We know that they're not who or what we are, and we're able to release them. They just actually start to release even by just looking at them through our observation. And then we come to this picture that's even a quieter aspect of that, because there's no friction with the fact that there's thinking. And then we start to, there's a much more space between thoughts. And when they arise, there's not resistance to them. There's not a struggle around them. The more struggle we have with the thinking mind, the more thoughts arise from that. You know, a common thing people ask about is what do you do with a song stuck in your head? And how do you work with that? You know, and I remember there's many years I would have that struggle. Songs would come and I'd just be stuck with, try to get rid of them. I just cannot get rid of them. The more I try to ignore them, the stronger they get. And eventually I noticed that it stopped being a problem. And I realized that I stopped having an argument with a song being present or not being present. So a song would arise, I would notice it, I would hear it, feel the emotional elements in it, but there'd be no friction with the fact that the song was there. And because there's no friction, there's nothing for it to stick to. It falls away. I don't want the song to be there, guarantees it to stay. Isn't that a fun paradox? So in this picture, we've learned that. We've stopped struggling with our thinking mind. And there's a silence that just starts to naturally arise. There's lots of space between the thoughts. When thoughts do arise, they don't have that self-referencing. They're not sensitive. Well, that's my thought. That's me. That's who I am. They're simply arising out of stillness. And we often try to teach that in instructions. See, you know, treats thoughts like from the Tibetan tradition of like thought, like clouds going across the sky. The spacious sky holds them without any kind of struggle. It just has a spaciousness to it, and the thoughts come and go. So these three elements, are a big part of what happens in this image of what is released, our sense of relationship to time, our sense of doing, of having to control, to fix, and the sense of our relationship to thought. Thoughts just start to fall away. Not because we're trying to do it, but they just, our relationship has changed, and we see thought just as another experience. So the next question is, well, how do we help this stage arise? It sounds kind of nice, doesn't it? How do I get there? And some of us, have experienced this and know what that's like. And some of us have had tastes of it and maybe very fleeting. And some of us had tastes of it and don't even realize it. I think it's helpful just to describe that, how that arises. Because it also teaches us how to start to change our practice to create the conditions for this to happen more and more. And again, going back to that statement about the spectrum of this, that this picture is really a big, broad way of experiencing this really profound way. We can also see it in a very small way. It's just in a momentary thing in the day that there's a natural, I'm just here. I don't have to do anything with the moment. Our minds tend to jump over that because it doesn't grab us. There's nothing to fix in that moment. There's nothing to argue about. There's nothing to do different. But eventually we start to actually orient more and more to that. We recognize that's actually worth resting into. And then those moments start to expand more and more. And the first way that this arises, and that's kind of built into how these images unfold, is through sustained practice. Now this is what many practices, regardless of their tradition, different traditions in Buddhism, different religious traditions, a lot of the contemplative, mystical, they're aimed toward this picture. How do we have that picture arise? And often it does require a lot of sustained practice. At least I'll talk about it some other ways it can arise, but the first way is through sustained practice, often retreat practice. So retreat practice has the advantage of taking away all our responsibilities. All we have to do is just meet ourselves moment after moment, generally train our minds. And if those of you going to retreat, you know that there's often the initial stage of unrest and distraction and struggle, sleepiness. And at some point, that starts to quiet down. There's a stillness that starts to rise more and more. And then there's maybe a new wave of unease or struggle comes up, and that starts to quiet down. But this is kind of this process, is kind of our momentum of our mindfulness starts to build and build. And while it's building, we're also at the same time, in a way, purifying all our restrictions, our purifying our what's unclear in us. You could say our delusions, our patterns of reactivity, because we're just meeting them as they arise. And as we meet them, and skillfully at least, they start to lose their power. They start to release again and again. Just by being present with them, just learning how not to add fuel to them. So retreat practice can be very helpful. It's been helpful for me, helpful for many people. But some of us can't go on retreats. So we'll talk about some other ways that this picture can arise. Also, one more thing about retreat practice is that once we start to get taste of that, it's much easier to see it in daily life because it becomes like this guidepost. We recognize that. Now, I've heard a number of people say this, and I've noticed it too, that sometimes we do those dyads, and when one person is asking a question, other person's responding. So it's almost like a real-time reminder to look deeper and deeper. If it's done in a sincere way, in a fruitful way, it can feel like even like a 5-minute, 10-minute dyad, it can feel like you've dropped into the middle of a retreat because it's that change of perspective. And we'll talk about that sense of investigation, how that's also a very powerful gateway into this picture. Because this daily life, versus retreat, they do have their pluses and minuses. Retreat, we are you know, we've really let go of a lot of our responsibilities. Daily life, we have all those responsibilities. How do we navigate our relationships, our work? How do we navigate our bodies and all this stuff going on? So, and that's actually the big advantage of daily life. Because that natural friction and rub that comes up with those interactions, that if you look at it in a spiritual way, and we'll talk about this tonight, the vertical question example, it becomes a way of really seeing the very edges of your own practice. And sometimes those edges become harder to see, at least some of them, on retreat practice, because you don't have the interactions. You don't have the responsibilities that bring them up in the same way. Not to say retreat doesn't bring up those things too, but you just don't have had the same kind of feedback, the same kind of pressure. But the difficulty that there is so many distractions. So this is where investigation and inquiry comes in as a very powerful way for this picture to arise. So let's define investigation and inquiry as this really sincere looking and questioning, this willingness to turn toward and understand what's the nature of this moment? What's the nature of this reactivity, this emotion, this rub? What's the nature of this beauty, of this sense of peace? And turning toward it with a sense of curiosity, a sense of really sincere willingness to be changed by that seeing. That willingness to be seen is so critical. Because for willingness to be changed by what we see, then it transforms us. But if we're not willing to be transformed, we're seeing through our normal ideas, our normal opinions, our normal concepts. And that keeps us stuck in our normal patterns. There's also the accuracy of how we're looking. Looking in a clear way toward what causes suffering, what releases that suffering. Now, the Buddha was really a master in this. In the suttas, there's many examples of how he would share his own process, if you will, of practicing, how he would ask questions. Like there's the two kinds of thoughts that lead to suffering, the thoughts that lead to freedom. Just to realize that, oh, I can kind of weigh those two. I can choose which I put my energy into. There's times he just was very insightful and accurate. He really honed it more and more closely to what's the root of dukkha, the root of suffering. And he also would use questionings to help guide others for their own awakening, their own growth as practice. There's a sutta when he's talking to his son, Rahula, who was an ordained monk. And he's talking to Rahula. He's saying, okay, what do you think, Rahula? Is the I constant or inconstant? Okay, so when he talks about the I, he's talking about the faculty of seeing, the process of being able to actually see. And Rahula says, well, it's inconsistent, right? It's not always the same. It's always changing. Light conditions, you know, being tired in the morning, gunk in your eye, it changes. The capacity of the eye just changes. If you're blind, if you have sight impairment, it's not a constant thing. It's not a given thing. As we get older, our eyes don't see as well. So it's inconsistent. And then the Buddha asks, is that which is inconsistent easeful or stressful? It's a simple question. But the way the Buddha is skillfully guiding him is just notice it. It's something that's consistent or inconsistent. Is it useful or stressful? And it's stressful because we can't count on it. We can't count it to always be the same. Now, if you looked at my fonts of my talks, you could see my deterioration of my eyesight as they get bigger and bigger. I used to have 12 font was fine, and now I'm like 14 font, and I found a font that's even a bigger size on the paper. And it's inconsistency. There's a stressfulness. There's a level of stress, of dukkha with that. Okay, then he goes, you know, the Buddha just dialing down, circling down in a very gentle way, spiraling around And this is the nature of investigation. It takes something Western media and start to follow it down to a place that leads to insight and to seeing. Okay, so it's stressful. Now, the Buddha says, is it fitting to regard what is inconsistent, stressful, subject to change as mine? This is myself. This is what I am. So is something that's inconsistent, that's changing, that's stressful. Is that really what I am? Is that who I am? Is that something that's solid? And the Buddha said no. I mean, the Rahula said no. And he goes on to different aggregates and different states of consciousness. That's I consciousness, your consciousness. That's what I mean by that. At some point, always going to the sense of, okay, if it's in change, is it really who you are? Is it really what you are? Or is it something else beyond that, what you really are? And Rahula in this sutta says, while this explanation was being given, Venerable Rahula's mind, through non-clinging, not being sustained, was fully released and became enlightened, became awakened from that inquiry. And so this wasn't like after this long period of meditation. It wasn't this long process. Of course, Rahula had trained himself to meditate. He had practiced deeply. So he's right to look closely. But the most important part was the sincerity of looking, of clear seeing. And that's where daily life really thrives. But you have to provide that sincerity. You have to provide that willingness to look. Only you can give that. There's two modern meditation or spiritual teachers, I should say, Eckhart Tolle and Byron Katie, who both came from a tremendous amount of dukkha, tremendous amount of suffering, depression, just this level of deep, deep suffering. And somehow by really turning toward that, they saw through the sense of self. They saw that the root, that the sense of me was really what was keeping them suffering. The suffering was too much to go through. And so they learned to release that sense of self. And they've gone on to become very powerful spiritual teachers, very, very helpful, both in their own way of expressing that. But sometimes the dukkha is just so much that we can't hold it. So then we learn how to see, okay, maybe what needs to be released is my relationship to that dukkha. And we start to spiral in through these questions as the Buddha instructed Rahula. We start to see maybe releasing that sense of identification. That's where the pain really is. That's where the suffering is. And this comes to the homework. I didn't give much instructions in that, but let me just unpack that a little bit. That's Rodney's, one of his favorite teachings was the vertical question. His vertical question, he framed it as, usually we're in this horizontal realm, right? I'm here, tomorrow I'm going to do this, next week I'm going to do that. 2 weeks ago, I did that. So there's a sense of horizontalness, all the doing, all the stuff that fell away that I talked about early on. So a vertical question, he described it as this coming right into the middle of this moment. And it's a question of inquiry, a question that can, in some ways, cut through a very reactive moment. He would often use examples like, where is there love in this moment? In the middle of an argument with my loved one. Where's their love in this moment? Where's their stillness? Where's their peace? Sometimes I just use that felt sense of that stillness of this state of this picture as a guy. Where is that in this moment? And by asking it, it actually starts to reveal itself. You can fall right into the middle of that, right into that moment. It may take a little while, but remember those dyads. Maybe we'll do a dyad next week. We ask that question, it allows us to spiral in deeper and deeper. And there can be this, we find ourselves in the middle of this picture where there's nothing that needs to be done. There's nothing that needs to be changed. And so finally, the shift of the practice, when we find ourselves in the midst of this, when this arises either from our sustained practice, or just out of the blue, who don't know why it's here. Maybe we have experienced suffering, it's here. Maybe we've been doing inquiry and suddenly it arises. For whatever reason, some life event, we're suddenly in the midst of this picture. It's a sense of stillness, a sense of nothing needs to be done with this moment. There's a perfection in this moment. How do we shift our practice? It's really a shifting into much more subtle, much more quiet, quieter and quieter. It's really treading on this edge of the mystery. There's less and less effort, less and less you trying to do something. It's so easy to make splashes here, and because there's going to be a part of us when we start to realize this picture is here, we're like, you know, I'm not really so defined in this picture. I don't really know quite what I am in this picture. Because what I am has been based on what I do, for example. What I am has been based on what I think. It's how I relate to time. When that falls away, there can be an existential dis-ease or disconcertment or even panic. Like, I don't know who I am. If you can learn to just relax into that, that's right. And that gateway of the self starting to fall away, the ego starting to fall away. So practicing surrendering into that. I remember working with Rodney once on a retreat and just observing the stillness and these really quiet, subtle terrain. And he said that, you know, you're really good at observing it, but now it's time to really wade into that stillness, to surrender into that stillness. And that's what this starts to switch from us doing, from our techniques, from that raft we talked about, to just surrendering. But in that moment, it starts to deepen and deepen. And then from this picture, we move in to the next. All right, let's sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. Even as we sit quietly together, see if there can be a dropping away into that stillness, into that quiet. And perhaps it's not so far away, it's actually always here. We just cover it up, we just forget. All right, thank you for your engagement in that talk. And before we open to some questions or sharing, I'd like to just talk about the homework a little bit more. So it's simply to craft your own personal vertical question, you know, for your practice. I could give you one. I think it's much more powerful for you to find your own. And that's one that is something that you find very compelling in your spiritual practice. It might be something like love. It might be something like connection. It might be something like equanimity or peace. It could be something like stillness. And so the way Rodney often framed it is to ask, where's your stillness in this moment? Where's your love in this moment? And if it's a compelling question, it's going to kind of pull you out of your activity, because it's that topic or that inquiry is more important than the details of the struggle, the reactivity. It's something you want very dearly from your heart. Your heart really yearns for it. And you'll notice that when you find the right question, you naturally become a little quieter inside. There's a way that you're able to go from being caught in an argument to just, oh, I can actually listen. I can actually hear the other person's point of view in that moment. I can actually take my tunnel vision off and actually see the broadness of the landscape. Something that helps us drop into the midst of that stillness in the midst of our life. All right, so hopefully that makes sense. If you have any questions about that, you can ask that, and we'll explore that next week some more with the discussion. So we do have some time now for any questions before announcements. And if you have a question online, you can just raise your hand and I'll call on you. And here in person, you can also raise your hand. And we can dialogue or just hear what you have to say. Yes, do you mind grabbing that mic so they can hear you online? It doesn't magnify into the room, it's just the people online can hear you better. Just pick it up and put it next to your mouth.
Okay.
Let me turn this so they can see.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear her okay?
Can you hear me?
Yep, they can hear you.
Yeah. Okay, I'll try.
I can repeat your question.
I try. Yeah, let's see. You know, when you are in the moment, say you're having an argument with your partner and, you know, things come out the way that you regret later, I guess. And so, like what you just said is, you were saying how where you're in the moment. And you're not what you say, but what you feel or believe. But that is something that you can't really convey to the person that you just hurt or had a fight with or had a disagreement with. And I don't know, as human beings, I feel like I could always go back and realize, oh God, I shouldn't have gotten so upset. Or that, but you know, it's the damage has been done, but you know, you didn't mean it. You just lost your temper, but the other person does not see that or might even take it as an excuse. You know, if you try to say, I didn't really mean that. I just, you know, I lost my temper and it's not what I really believe or really think. How do you convey it in a way to resolve or get beyond the argument or get beyond the disagreement to caring about each other again?
Yes, that's a great question. So let me just paraphrase it for those in the room and see if I captured it. So talking about arguments, you know, we sometimes say things which are hurtful, that cause harm, but we not mean it. It's kind of coming up at our own hurt qualities, our reactions, but it has an impact. And even though we may understand that we didn't really mean that, there's still a sense of, there may be a sense of like that stillness inside, there's still the fact that this person's been impacted. How do you work with that? How do you navigate that? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Damage has been done.
Damage has been done. How do you repair that? And in relationship to what we're talking about. So I'm going to just turn back here. I don't know, Faith.
And I will add, it actually continues in both directions. But you don't know how the other person is feeling, even though you might be regretting what you said. But it's that moment, in the moment thing that you regret.
Yes. So it's a really important question. It's a very, you know, nitty gritty and how do we practice with these things that come up in our lives, right? Because this happens. I've experienced that, you know, many times being married to the same person for, you know, 20 years together, 25 years. There's lots of times we get into those really tough spots. Maybe not lots of times, but there's.
And the pandemic helped add to this a lot. The pandemic is just cooped up for so long.
Yeah, so the pandemic certainly is a factor of that. But even without the pandemic, it still happens because we're human beings, right? So the interesting point is that, okay, that we can only really have any kind of influence on the present moment. That's really what's here. And we can have harm that's kind of still kind of affecting the present moment. And this is, we can remember that hurt. We can feel that sense of reactivity, that sense of being shamed or negated or whatever it might be. But the real power of it is the willingness to simply show up and be present with that person. And that's where you really, the practice comes to bear. Because if I can meet like with my wife, for example, and sit with her after I've said something that was unkind or harmful, and be willing to really listen to the impact of that, to really say, okay, I want you to tell me how I've caused harm. Let me hear your experience. And I go into a place of not trying to defend myself, not trying to judge her, not trying to justify, not trying to explain, but really to deeply, deeply understand her, her experience, what she's gone through. And, you know, a concrete way that I like to do this, you know, in real life with my spouse is she might say something and then I would hear it and I would try to paraphrase it. And then she could tell you if you actually got it right or not. Right? And more importantly, there's a point where it starts to shift that we're no longer defending against each other. We're actually starting to listen to each other's hurts. And that's present moment practice. That's the willingness to show up and be present and being willing to be undefended. And then after a while, after they've spoken and they feel like they're kind of at a resting spot, then you get to share. And share, you know, try to share from a deep place, the sense of owning your experience. But if they're also in a solid place or a receptive place, they can hear you and paraphrase. And it's so amazing how often the things that we're most hurt by wasn't really what the argument was about. You know, it's like we picked something and we lashed out. But it's a much more tender place that we're kind of dancing around. But it does take the willingness to be with each other and to talk. And if, you know, the person's not willing, you could write about it. You can have that sense of writing and maybe having some proxies. But it's a really powerful process, you know, if the other person's willing. And you have to fully own what you did. Understand that even though you may not have intended to cause harm, harm was caused. Let me hear that. And then that way they can hear that, okay, even though there was harm, this person still cares about me. They're still connected. Hey, thank you for asking. That's a courageous question, and I think it's part of being human. You know, how do we go through that? How do we meet each other? Yeah. All right, thank you. All right, so let's see if there's anybody online who'd like to share anything or ask anything. Oh, yeah, Jeannie, go ahead.
Yeah,
oh, you're a... That was an applaud?
No. I'm sorry, that was a hand.
Okay, all right, go ahead, Jeannie.
Shoot, I lost you.
Go ahead, you can talk. I'm just muting myself.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is kind of an observation. I lost my cat ran down the stairs last week, and I let him out in the morning, and the neighbor had called me like an hour later and said he curled up and passed away. And this cat I've had for 15 years. And I was able to, through the practice, I was able to really meet the moment. And I realized, because that kind of pain, I would always divert of it because it was so great, you know? And I didn't have his time to say goodbye. If only I would have known when he was running down the stairs, you know, all that. But I realized the difference between the thinking and the pain is deep in your, like in your chest, your throat. And I was able to really sit with that. And I realized, you know, through the practice about clinging and realizing this was exactly the way he was going to go. I mean, I thought, what a beautiful way to go. You know, he lived outside where he wanted to be and stuff, you know, but, and I guess it has to do with aging and seeing your own aging. But really, you know, I was able to go towards the pain and feel it like in a really conscious way. And it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. You know, it really was a chance to really practice the practice, you know, because I always diverted from pain, you know, either, you know, have a drink or you talk with friends or get another animal, you know, but I was really able, and it kind of just brought a really beauty to his presence. You know, I mean, I got to appreciate it. And now with my other animals, I get to really realize that, you know, like your dog walking down, that's going to be gone someday, you know, and I just been able to, and aging too, you know, and people that you love are aging with you. And I'm losing somebody right now, a dear one through old age. And anyway, I just wanted to share that I really got to feel the practice and use it instead of always thinking the mind, but it wasn't the head. It was totally the heart. And it was a different feeling that I've never felt before. Anyway, I just wanted to share. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, Jeannie. Yeah, that's that moment of turning toward, that willingness to turn toward and feel that pain. I mean, that shows, you know, how the practice really comes forth. That shows how it's really blossomed in your heart. Mm-hmm. And that becomes this guidepost for you that, oh, I can turn toward pain. I can turn toward grief. And it won't be so bad. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think you've also described it as being more enlivening. You're actually feeling what's present, and you're feeling that tenderness of connection with your other animals and with your loved ones, with your friend who's slowly passing away. And there's a way that it's that turning toward actually makes us more alive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. All right, anyone back in the room who'd like to share anything? And back online. Maddie or Matt, sorry, Matt, go ahead.
Hey, it is Maddie, actually. Hey, how's it going? I had a question about, so you were describing during your talk, like that quality of having more space around your thoughts that you develop through practice, and how you can start to notice that, you know, not just during your practice, but throughout your day. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on, bringing that quality to thinking during times when like thinking is the main activity, like during work, for example, like the work I do, you know, kind of my activity for 8 hours a day is thinking very hard. And I notice, you know, sometimes when I pay attention after that day, like has quite a toll on my mental energy. And I, you know, I've been so wrapped up in that not very spacious thought, very contracted, you know, focused thinking for so long that it, you know, really wear me out. And I've always, you know, imagine what it would be like to bring, like, you know, spacious thinking or some quality like that to, like, you know, my work. But I wonder if you've had experience like that or any thoughts on how to develop that quality, I guess.
Sure. So how do you work with, you know, a job or activity that requires a lot of mental, you know, conscious effort and energy and cultivation to really, you know, problem solve and think something through? How does that sense of space around thought, how does that work with that? Or is that possible? And it's, I remember one teacher was describing a very successful business person, and they would, you know, be in the middle of a meeting and they get up, and you know, they must've been in charge. So they could just get up in the middle of the meeting. They get up and, you know, just kind of look out the window for a minute or so and then come back. And in that looking out the window, they were actually using that as to really release a thought, connect to the body, come into the sensations, or maybe doing a sweep through the body, just to notice what's present. And so, and then that actually allowed them to be much more engaged and productive and effective in their jobs. So you might play with that even when you're having to really focus on something, to give yourself just even 30 seconds here and there, just feel the breath, feel a couple breaths, just kind of let the thought go for a moment. Feel, and also feel the, you know, maybe whatever might the body's reaction to that thought. And sometimes that little bit of stepping back, even though it seems like you need to be just productive, 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 a little bit of stepping back actually sometimes opens up solutions that you hadn't kind of thought of. And so it's like you start to, and it's also the process of starting to use the mind really as the tool it can be. It can be. You're really using it in a skillful way, in a logical way, and you're really clarifying that. And you start to notice when it starts to spin out a little bit, it starts to become a little dull or a little bit spinning in its wheels. And then you can start to, okay, let me maybe take that little bit of a break, reconnect, and then coming back into that task again. I think a good thing to do also is just throughout the day, if you can, take a little bits of respite, you know, focus on the breath, focus on walking, going to the bathroom, feeling your feet touching the ground, consciously releasing thought again and again. And then when you pick it back up, you pick it up with clarity. Like when I write a talk, I mean, the talk doesn't just kind of show up. It's often a process of reflecting. You know, sometimes there's this different things pop up and then I kind of order it around it. But there's this engagement of the mind and the thought process and also lots of stillness, feeling in the body at the same process. So hopefully that helps, Natty. All right, anyone back here in the room? Yeah, Cheryl, come on down. Oops, let me try.
I'm not really sure what I'm going to say, but I've noticed, you know, I've been having a struggle with my partner. You know, we're probably going to having to move and everything else, and I haven't wanted to, and it's been a, I can't even describe it. It's the practice. It's like all the, you know, in the beginning, investigation, what's that? I, you know, it felt like I had to figure out what the problem was. I had to find the problem. I had to fix it. But over time, and especially, you know, as things have really gotten huge, my practice has been a lot about, you know, what do I believe is true in this moment? And with my partner, for a long time, I believed that that everything was unfair and I was being put upon, and, you know, this is all her fault. And, you know, how could you get sick? Like, I mean, it's really, I mean, it was the, you know, asshole with a capital A kind of thing. And it's almost like I wasn't getting my own way. And the practice, it's almost like, where is this thought coming from? Where, and that's the investigation. Mm-hmm. Where is this thought coming from? And what do I really believe in this moment? And when I found, you know, where is the love here? When I found that, it's there now. And it's almost like, I don't know how it came back, but it's there now. And it almost feels like I can't go back to feeling angry with her again. Like we are partners now in this, and we're going to get through it. But it's, it's the practice. And I think it's, you know, and like I'll do, and you're right, retreat is very helpful. And all the online retreats were really helpful because I got to practice at home, and that was, and I still do online retreats. They're still available. So, but yeah, I'll notice like something's weird going on in there, and I can feel myself getting tense, and I can feel that something's not right. And I'm at it, the practice is so ingrained now in a way that, and it's not always, but like, you know, it's so ingrained that I'll go, well, yeah, what's going on here? And I'll also, you know, there are times when I want to hang on to that suffering. I'm so attached to it, you know, and I don't want to let it go. But I don't even, that's not even as relevant anymore. Anyway, I just wanted to say that the practice, it's like it's doing itself. It's doing itself in a way. And, you know, I'm feeling good now. And I was even thinking on the way over here, what's different? And it's like, I feel right with my view. I feel right with my effort. I feel right with my intentions. Like the Eightfold Path is like coming together for me right here. So I don't know. Just wanted to share that.
Great. Thank you, Cheryl. Sure. Yeah, yeah, just the power of that willingness to turn toward, to meet, to you know, ask those questions of the heart. And yeah, we by doing that, I mean, you're going to see sometimes the content, like the difficult relationship with your partner, you know, the situations that she's going through, just it's kind of embedded in that. It brings up all our edges. But if we're willing just to keep meeting that, you know, even though it seems so much struggle, it starts to transform. And that's really the power of just seeing clearly. And then we start to find, yes, something has really shifted. And that's why like this picture, it's is that we just kind of fall into that. It just kind of arises. And it's often it's that willingness to look, to see, to be present, even with some things which are very difficult, as you talked about, as the first person mentioned. So thank you, Cheryl. All right, maybe one more question if there's anyone out there, and then we can go to a couple announcements. Yes, come on over, Beth.
So when I saw the homework today, I've got a frog in my throat, excuse me. I saw the homework today. I'm like, oh, the vertical question. You know, it was like, okay, there it is again. It's always there. And I've been doing this for a long time. And to this very moment, there's this, It's fainter now, but there is a feeling of belief in my historic mind. I'm sure it's a developmental thing, that there's something really wrong with this moment. Mm-hmm. And I've developed over the years, over my growing up in adulthood, a history of like rushing the moment, like getting past it. Even my house cleaning is like, just get it done. That's my go-to. And I read that before we sat, and I sat with, during the sit, I went to just, you know, just this, right? Just this. And I thought this, I think I actually came to, it's okay that you feel like there's something wrong with this moment. Like there was that meta feeling, you know, like a new level of understanding that I'm still feeling this way. There's still a thought this way, and it's not going to change. And there's something, and there was the intuitional level or something said, you know, so there it is. You know, the moment is like this.
Great. Thank you, Beth. Let me see if I can paraphrase that. So we're talking about the vertical question and kind of a conditioning to always see there's something wrong with the moment, that there's an inherent flaw in the moment or imperfection in the moment, how strong that it is and how much of a struggle that has been. And something about tonight, you know, reflecting on the homework, it's that kind of softened a bit. Not so much that, it's more like the relationship to it softened. You know, so you stop making the fact that you're seeing a problem with the moment being a problem.
Yes, yes.
Right?
There's a problem, another problem.
That's right. So, and that is a really significant shift. It's because as long as we see something as a problem, we're just kind of reinforcing that. And we can get really good at judging the judgment, and judging the judgment, that judging, you know, we just kind of gets locked more and more tight. But just a little bit of space like that, that sense of, and it's a physical thing, as you, if you could see her in the room, she's just like, yeah, this is okay. This is still here. It's going to be here. But there's an okayness. This is how it is in this moment. Yeah. Right. So that's that little bit of a gateway there, that you're relating to it. You're not lost in it. You're actually seeing it. And by doing that, you eventually be able to see that just another belief. It's just another thought.
Okay.
And you might play with maybe a question like, okay, what's perfect about this moment? where's their perfection in this moment? The dirty house, the this and that. It's like, where's the perfection? It's like, it's calling your attention to see that. It's calling you into the middle of that. And that starts to slowly show that there is an inherent perfection. The imperfection is really coming from our own minds, from our history, from our conditioning. You developed that for a reason. It was helpful at some point, and maybe it's not serving us so much anymore. But not judging it, not hating it, just acknowledging it, and it starts to loosen. Thank you, Beth. All right, thank you all. And next week we'll have a discussion and a recap talk of this exploration. Have a wonderful evening.